Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the September 10th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. Walking through one of our local supermarkets last week, the front page headline of USA Today on the news rack caught my eye. "Can Russia be stopped?" it read in bold black letters. While surrounding it were pictures of world leaders, including our own President Obama, expressing their concerns over what they describe as Russia's invasion of the Ukraine and the likelihood that its President Vladimir Putin might have his eye on one or more of the Baltic nations, once part of the Soviet Union and now members of NATO. While Putin has neither said nor done anything that might indicate he is thinking of sending Russian troops into Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania, Obama did not hesitate in committing U.S. troops to come to their defense as part of a NATO force should Russia do so. He made that promise in a speech last week in Tallinn, Estonia's capital, on the eve of the NATO summit in Wales, being well aware the NATO chiefs, among them himself, would be announcing the creation of a 4,500-member spearhead force to counter perceived Russian aggression. They did so even as the new post-coup Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko was engaged in discussions with Putin in trying to arrange a ceasefire between Kiev and the pro-Russian rebels and separatists in eastern Ukraine. The region known as the Donbass had been under constant bombardment by government troops since the rebels followed their public displeasure with a February coup by declaring their intent to break away from the pro-Western Kiev government that had been elected in its aftermath. What has been missing from the U.S. and the Western press has been coverage of the more than 2,500 Ukrainians who have been killed by the Kiev government's indiscriminate bombing raids and the fact that those raids have led to over 500,000 Russian-speaking Ukrainians to flee across the Russian border for safety. What also has been missing from the on-air discussions are the real reasons behind the current East-West confrontation. That's what we'll be looking at today. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be speaking again with veteran journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News, whose recent article on the whys behind the Ukrainian crisis explains why the U.S. and NATO have been so willing to drag the world toward the threshold of a nuclear war. One of its crisis points was the downing of a Malaysian Airlines flight, MH17, over the eastern Ukrainian battlefield in July, which the U.S. and its NATO allies were quick to blame on the Russian-backed rebels without feeling obliged to present any evidence to back it up. While rebels secured the black boxes and turned them over to Dutch officials, ongoing attacks by Ukrainian forces in the area made it impossible to conduct a thorough on-the-ground investigation. On my last program, I reported how the recording of the conversations between the Ukrainian air traffic controllers and pilots of the doomed Malaysian flight before it went down were either missing or unavailable. Now, a month after the crash, they have apparently surfaced, and a partial transcript was included in the preliminary report of the Dutch Safety Board on the causes of the crash released yesterday. The Associated Press reported the agency, quote, stopped short of saying the Boeing 777 was shot down by a missile, but its findings appear to point to that conclusion. It also did not say who might have been responsible, end quote. It did say, however, that flight MH17 was struck by multiple, quote, high-energy objects from outside the aircraft, end quote, causing it to break up over the eastern Ukraine. According to the report, quote, the damage observed in the forward section of the aircraft appears to indicate that the aircraft was penetrated by a large number of high-energy objects from outside the aircraft. It is likely that this damage resulted in a loss of structural integrity of the aircraft, leading to an in-flight breakup, end quote. Anyway, it goes on, more research will be necessary to determine the cause with greater precision. The Safety Board believes that additional evidence will become available for investigation in the period ahead. Detailed examination of the structural damage is ongoing, the report said. Forensic examination will be performed if the wreckage can be removed, end quote. According to the Dutch report, there were two other passenger jets in the air at the same time, but there's no mention of the Ukrainian fighter jet that reportedly appeared on the Russian radar in the vicinity of flight MH17 before it was hit. The fact that the holes in the fuselage could have been made by a fighter jet raking the side of the plane with heavy caliber machine gun fire has led to speculation that the downing of MH17 was a false flag attack carried out by the Ukrainian government designed to place the blame on the rebels and their backer, President Putin. What is curious is that following the NATO meeting in Wales, which resulted in added pressure on the European Union to expand sanctions against Russia, and the introduction of NATO's new 4,500-man spearhead force that will operate within the countries of the former USSR, or Russia's western border, not a small risk-free undertaking, it has for the moment taken a backseat to another crisis engendered by Washington. That, of course, is the emergence of the Islamic State and the perceived need for President Obama to look tough in confronting it. A major question looming there is whether he will follow the will of his military advisors and Congress and extend that confrontation into Syria, which has been battling the Islamic State and its jihadist allies for the past 3 years. The Ukrainian government, that all of them have been funded and armed by the Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and many have been trained by Washington in order to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, makes the situation a bit sticky. But the mainstream media can be counted on to safely package the obvious contradictions for public consumption. We are 1 day shy of the 13th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And while we are still in the throes of 9/11's predictable, and may I dare say planned, after effects, pressing questions about the official narrative of that most decisive event yet of the 21st century still remain a taboo subject for the U.S. media across the spectrum from Fox News to Democracy Now. Putting aside for the moment speculation about what actually caused the buildings of the World Trade Center to collapse as they did, why is there no discussion about the fact that none of the alleged planners of the attack, who have allegedly confessed, admittedly under torture, have been brought to trial? There is also a 28-page section, a whole chapter from the Joint Inquiry into Intelligence Activities before and after the terrorist attacks on September 2001, made by Congress, that George W. Bush classified when he was president and which remains classified under Obama. 11 members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, have signed on as co-sponsors of the House Resolution 428, which challenges, quote, the executive branch's decision to maintain the classified status of these pages that prevents the people of the United States from having access to information about the involvement of certain foreign governments, plural, in the terrorist attacks, end quote. The resolution calls on the Obama administration to release the redacted pages to the American public. There was a remarkable piece of investigative journalism in Sunday's New York Times that revealed that more than a dozen prominent Washington think tanks have received tens of millions of dollars from foreign governments in recent years while pushing U.S. government officials to adopt policies that reflect the donors' priorities. The money, according to the Times, is increasingly transforming the once-staid think tank world into a muscular arm of foreign governments lobbying in Washington. And it has set off troubling questions, says the paper, about intellectual freedom. Some scholars say they have been pressured to reach conclusions friendly to the government financing the research. All in all, 57 governments have been involved in contributing money to the various think tanks. There is one country that is notably missing from the list, Israel. With so many well-placed American-born Jewish loyalists ready to perform services for the state they consider to be their historic homeland, there is obviously no need for Israel to pay for what it has long been getting for free. Moving on to the Israel-Palestine conflict, in the aftermath of Israel's bloody 50-day assault on Gaza, which took over 2,100 Palestinian lives, 70% of them civilians, and left the country's infrastructure destroyed, we see that nothing has changed in a material way for Gazans since the ceasefire, except that Palestinian fishermen may now safely sail their boats 6 miles from shore instead of being limited to 3. The Palestinian Authority's unelected president, Mahmoud Abbas, whose popularity among Palestinians is reportedly at an all-time low, is putting aside his threats that were never serious to take Israel to the International Criminal Court over its crimes in Gaza. Instead, he's now calling on Israel to be given a 3-year deadline to evacuate the West Bank, a meaningless gesture which would change nothing on the ground and allow Israel to continue its settlement building without interruption. Abbas, who has yet to set foot in Gaza, has also threatened to break off a unity agreement with Hamas if it does not allow the government to function there. Speaking in Cairo ahead of an Arab League foreign ministers meeting, Abbas accused Hamas of running a shadow government and said he wanted a single authority and a single system of rule. "We will not accept the situation with Hamas continuing as it is at the moment," Abbas said on arrival at the Egyptian capital late on Saturday, according to the official Palestinian news agency WAFA. "We won't accept a partnership with them if the situation continues like this in Gaza, where there is a shadow government running the territory," end quote. Writing in Haaretz, Amos Harel reports that Israel's defense establishment, quote, "will recommend to politicians that they show generosity in indirect negotiations with Hamas when discussing conditions for a permanent ceasefire in order to forestall renewed hostilities at the end of September." A senior military source has told Haaretz, noted Harel, that it is in Israel's interest to avoid intense social and economic pressure on Gaza. "If we can assist by expanding fishing grounds and easing restrictions on border crossings of people and goods into and from Israel, this will help maintain the quiet," the source said. According to the article, Israel's, quote, "defense establishment will demand that specific measures are taken to supervise construction projects financed and managed by international agencies in order to prevent cement and concrete from being diverted to Hamas for rebuilding its tunnels and bunkers." Egypt, writes Harel, does not intend to fully open its border crossing into Gaza at Rafah. Before Operation Protective Edge, it permitted the crossing of 100 to 200 people a day based on humanitarian considerations, but on some days the crossing was closed. Israel estimates, the article goes on, that the numbers will be doubled, but not beyond that. Egypt is unwilling to allow the transfer of goods as the Palestinians would like to see. In view of Egypt's attitude, writes Haaretz, Amos Harel, "Reconstruction and improvement in the lives of Gaza's residents depends largely on Israel's attitude," end quote. And we have seen more than enough of Israel's attitude to know what that means. Another veteran Israeli writer who uses the name B. Michael, and who has been writing articles critical of Israeli policy for at least three decades, took aim at Netanyahu's hypocrisy in Haaretz on Monday. "A few days ago," writes B. Michael, "Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with two members of the U.S. Congress. We are closely following the events of the Golan Heights," he told them, adding, "What we see is a Nusra Front, Hamas, Hezbollah, backed by Iran, Al-Qaeda, and these other terrorist groups are basically defying all international norms." "So said the man," writes B. Michael, "who had just finished killing some 2,100 people, most of them civilians, breaching every norm of international conduct. So said the man whose Air Force, only a few days before, had wiped out whole residential neighborhoods, sometimes together with their inhabitants, trampling quite a few values and norms upon which the UN was founded." After that conversation, wrote B. Michael, Netanyahu went home. The next day he expropriated, in quotes, another 4,000 dunams, almost 1,000 acres of occupied land, to build more settlements and transfer to them thousands more of his country's citizens. Thus, concluded B. Michael and Haaretz, there was not one value, norm, international law, or treaty of all the values and norms and laws and treaties on which the United Nations was founded that he did not break, crush, smash, and pulverize. Meanwhile, back in the USA, the Reverend Bruce Shipman, the Episcopal chaplain at Yale University, learned that some things just cannot be said or written about Jews in this country, no matter how well-intended, if one wishes to keep one's job. On August 26th, Reverend Shipman had a letter published in the New York Times gently criticizing an op-ed piece by historian Deborah Lipstadt on the escalation of acts of anti-Semitism in Western Europe during Israel's assault on Gaza. "Deborah Lipstadt," wrote Shipman, "makes far too little of the relationship between Israeli policies in the West Bank and Gaza and growing anti-Semitism in Europe and beyond. The trend to which she alludes parallels the carnage in Gaza over the last 5 years, he writes, not to mention the perpetually stalled peace talks and the continuing occupation of the West Bank. As hope for a two-state solution fades and Palestinian casualties continue to mount, Shipman wrote, the best antidote to anti-Semitism would be for Israel's patrons abroad to press the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for final status resolution to the Palestinian question, end quote. That was it. Reverend Shipman's letter immediately created a firestorm within New England's pro-Israel circles and beyond, with calls for him to resign or be fired. He subsequently sent a letter to the Yale Daily News offering his apologies to, quote, all who have been offended. I believe, Shipman wrote, that there is a correlation between the uptick in anti-Semitic violence in the world and the events taking place in Israel, Palestine, and Gaza. That said, he wrote, there is never any excuse for such violence, and the crimes described by Professor Deborah Lipstadt are disgusting and repellent. There can be little doubt that many who engage in such behavior use the Israel-Palestine dispute as an excuse to mask a much deeper disorder known as anti-Semitism. I ought to have said this in my letter. I have been accused, Shipman wrote, of anti-Americanism for my opposition to the Vietnam War in the 60s and to the Iraq War. In fact, my patriotism runs deep, as does my love for Israel and Palestine and for the two peoples locked in a tragic fight over the land. If I seem to suggest in my letter that only Jews who actively oppose present Israeli policies have a right to feel safe, that was not my intention, nor is it my belief. Personal safety and protection by the rule of law is a fundamental right, Shipman wrote. Nothing done in Israel or Palestine justifies the disturbing rise in anti-Semitism in Europe or elsewhere. Persons of goodwill must be considered as well by the rise of Islamophobia that is now being justified in terms of national security. This has been a painful time for many of us, but I am a hopeful person, and I believe that good will come of it. I have received many letters that offer opportunities for dialogue and understanding, and I trust that I am humble enough to still be taught, end quote. 3 days ago, Reverend Bruce Shipman submitted his letter of resignation to Yale University.